there's been an overlap between elections and money throughout American political history, with money flowing in and out of campaigns to support candidates for public office.
What's changed in recent years, however, is where that money's going. Today, the amount that's being raised by third-party groups eclipses what candidates themselves are bringing in. Two candidates with significant backing from super PACs have already dropped out of the race to be the Republican presidential nominee. That's Rick Perry and Scott Walker.
Joining us to talk about what their fall says about super PACs and their influence is Ken Vogel. He's a chief investigative correspondent for Politico, and he's the author of the book Big Money, $2.5 billion, one suspicious vehicle and a pimp on the trail of the ultra-rich hijacking of American politics. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys.
Well, let's start, if we're not following the ins and outs of political campaigns, what exactly is a PAC and a super PAC in particular?
Yeah, a super PAC is a political action committee that can raise unlimited funds from individuals, corporations, and unions. It was sort of created by the 2010 Supreme Court decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission that said that laws that prohibited these types of groups from spending unlimited funds in campaigns were unconstitutional, essentially a violation of the freedom of speech. So one of the big caveats in that decision, though, was that sort of declaration, the stipulation that these groups had to be independent from the campaigns and the candidates in order to raise and spend unlimited funds supporting the candidates. What we've seen in this election in particular is a total abdication of that principle. We've seen groups that are very closely linked to candidates and campaigns raising unlimited funds expressly to back them, oftentimes run by the candidates' very close allies, and this very, very thin pretense of independence that a lot of the good government groups have said really violates the spirit of not just the few remaining laws that are in place that the Supreme Court has not struck down on campaign finance, but also the justices' stipulation that these groups be independent from the campaign.
We'll get into that idea of independence in just a few, but I want to talk about the receiving side of things, the money that's coming in. You mentioned the word unlimited, and that's what one of the things that makes these different than a campaign fundraising itself. The campaign has limits on how much it can take from any individual donor. Nothing like that for the super PAC?
No, not at all. In fact, we've seen the super PACs substantially outraise, as you alluded to, substantially outraise the campaigns themselves. So the super PACs that are supporting these candidates have raised around $275 million. That's a whole lot more than the campaigns are raising. We need look no further than Jeb Bush, the field leader on the Republican side in fundraising, who raised about $10 million into his campaign in the first 6 months of the year. During that same time, the super PACs raised about $100 million. So you see right there the disparity, and it allows these very, very wealthy partisans, these activists, to really get behind a candidate in a way that the campaign contribution limits, as enacted by Congress and upheld by the Supreme Court, envision prohibiting against.
And when political action committees were started, and we've heard of in the past, there's the notion that they might support a candidate here, a candidate there, a state guy here, a woman running for Senate over there. Now we're seeing these super PACs that are very clearly attached to just one candidate and only one candidate. When did that start happening?
That started happening in about 2012 during the presidential race. We saw that both candidates, Mitt Romney and President Obama, and their allies start super PACs to support them expressly. And if you talk to campaign finance reform advocates, those are the folks who tried to prevent the Citizens United decision and have argued for changes to the law and to the regulations that would sort of dial back the impact of it since then. They say that just the very practice of starting a super PAC to support one candidate is really a violation of the spirit of the rules that say that you cannot coordinate, these unlimited money groups cannot coordinate with a candidate. Well, they say if you have a group, if you have a super PAC that's raising unlimited funds just to support one candidate, then even if they obey the coordination prohibitions that say that you cannot get together to decide how to make an advertisement and have the campaign shaping the super PACs political advertising or vice versa, just the mere fact that you have a super PAC that supports a single candidate is sort of a violation of the spirit of that coordination prohibition.
Talking to Ken Vogel from Politico about super PACs in the presidential race. So one limit maybe they're running up against, you just mentioned there, Ken. And another one, apparently, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, both had a good chunk of change in their super PACs. But Rick Perry, unable to pay his own campaign staff, bailed out of the campaign. Scott Walker left the campaign saying not enough money coming into his campaign. So it sounds like there are some limits to the power of the super PAC.
Yeah, that's right. And that, you know, while these super PACs can, in fact, take on many of the sort of traditional roles of a campaign in terms of advertising, in terms of even getting out the vote and organizing events, they cannot pay the salaries of the staffers who are required to run a campaign. They can't write speeches for the candidate. There are in fact limits, and this was the test case to see whether a candidate could, in fact, essentially run a campaign through a super PAC, sort of winking at the coordination prohibitions. In the case of Scott Walker, as well as Rick Perry, we saw that there were limits to that. There were limits to what a super PAC could do for a campaign, and both Scott Walker and Rick Perry were unable to raise the amount of money that was necessary, even to run really a bare-bones type of campaign that could be sort of subsidized and floated by a super PAC. So, you know, they probably ended up, they dropped out. The super PACs that supported them had raised $43 million. Those super PACs probably still have a fair amount of money in the bank that they're either going to be under pressure to return to their donors or find other ways to spend. And the fact that they couldn't spend that money fast enough while their candidates were in the race is a real indication, because if you know anything about political consultants, they find a way to spend the money, because in many cases their salaries are paid, and the amount of money that the money that they make is from commissions on advertising buys. So it's in their best interest to find ways to spend the money, and they couldn't do it because the campaigns were so cash strapped that the candidates themselves had to drop out.
Does this change the thinking then for a presidential candidate? Hey, we shouldn't work so hard to get those super rich donors to that super PAC. We should be focusing on getting people to donate up to the limit, or however much they can, to the actual campaign itself.
I think that was the lesson that some people took away from it. But for other people, it was really a traditional cautionary tale, which is that you build a campaign based upon your assessment of your cash flow. And Scott Walker in particular, maybe not so much Rick Perry, but Scott Walker built a very robust campaign infrastructure with a lot of staffers in a lot of different states, and just simply did not have the fundraising to support that. He probably could have scaled back. In fact, we talked to some of the donors to the super PACs when former Governor Perry and Governor Walker dropped out, and they said they would have preferred for the candidates to scale back their own campaigns, and the term that they use is live off the land, try to get as much free media as possible while letting the super PAC step in. But you sort of sacrifice some amount of control when you do that. And I think for Walker in particular, maybe not so much Perry, but for Walker in particular, he was probably unwilling to sacrifice that control and to scale back his campaign. Probably could have done it, but it would be really a shell of the campaign that he had hoped to run.
You've mentioned that this rule against coordination between the candidate's campaign and the super PAC is being winked at. How closely are these two entities being coordinated?
Well, in certain cases, I think there is, even if it's not the technical legal definition of coordination, there is what most observers, lay observers, and folks who obsessively follow this stuff like me and probably a lot of your audience would probably deem to be coordination. When you have actual events, political rallies that are being organized by the super PAC at which the candidate is appearing, which we see in the case of Carly Fiorina, who's surging in the polls, a former Hewlett-Packard CEO seeking the Republican nomination. I mean, that looks like coordination, but the laws themselves are very specific, and they say that what coordination entails is actually getting together to talk about political advertising spending strategy, to the point where you would have to be able to prove that a specific ad in a specific media market on a specific date was hatched, was planned, was produced, and aired in coordination between the super PAC and the political campaign. That is hard to do, particularly when you have a federal campaign watchdog, the Federal Election Commission, that by all accounts is sort of mired in gridlock and toothless and hasn't really pursued a lot of regulatory enforcement actions in recent years.
We're talking with Ken Vogel from Politico, looking at super PACs and whether they can allow big money donors to install the candidates they want.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Is campaign finance reform an issue that's important to you? Do you think that money is free speech and that donors should be able to contribute as much as they'd like to help their preferred candidate win? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is CentralTimeWPR. We're continuing our discussion with Ken Vogel about the role that super PACs are playing in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. He's a chief investigative correspondent for Politico.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the influence of big money donors on the American electoral process? Or do you think in the end it's about getting people to the polls to vote, big money or not? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Joanne is on the line in Eau Claire. Joanne, hi.
Hi. In my opinion, money does not equal free speech. I advocate for the repeal of Citizens United, and I would be very much in favor of the movement, which is Move to Amend, which is to remove Citizens United.
Joanne, thanks for the call. Ken, a lot of people out there thinking along those lines with Joanne, probably not going to change in the Supreme Court, it sounds like. Congress probably not going to move fast, so trying for this constitutional amendment. Do you, one way or another, Ken, see these things changing anytime soon?
I don't really see a whole lot of momentum for significant campaign finance reforms in Congress. There is some action at the state level. That's where a lot of the folks who are really advocating for scaling back the amount of money and the influence of money in our politics are looking. Typically, the major reforms come after major scandals, and you have to ask yourself, and a lot of the folks who are advocating for these types of reforms kind of shake their heads because they think that just the mere fact that so much money is pouring into our political process, that a super PAC supporting Jeb Bush can raise $100 million, to a lot of folks, that is a scandal in and of itself. So why won't that prompt reforms? Well, typically, the historical pattern has been a scandal that affects one particular candidate for office or elected official, where we see a sort of quid pro quo type situation where favor is given or by a candidate or an official who is elected with help from a particular donor or group of donors. You know, we can go all the way back to the robber barons, and it didn't take too long after that for Teddy Roosevelt to enact some reforms in 1904 that actually barred corporations from giving directly to campaigns, a measure that is still in place, you know, all the way up through Watergate, which saw the passage of the Federal Election Campaign Act. So is there a scandal like that out there? I certainly hope so. One sort of pessimistic note that I would sound, I say I certainly hope so. As a journalist who covers this stuff, I'd love to uncover something like that. But it's getting harder and harder to follow the money because so much of this money is being spent anonymously through nonprofit groups that don't have to disclose their donors. So the ability to follow the money and trace it all the way back to the donor who might be funding a group that might help elect a candidate that who then might turn around and do something in office that would be to the benefit of the donor, well, it's getting harder to trace that sort of money trail, and that is a very discouraging development for folks who are seeking reform.
Joanne, thanks for the call. We'll go to Tom next in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yes, I also wanted to comment that, you know, while I consider myself very progressive and I support Bernie Sanders for most of his ideas, I also think that it's important that while we're looking at corporate donations and politics and money from PACs, I think it's also important to notice that I believe that all that should be removed, but I also believe that money from, you know, other groups like unions should be treated the same as PACs. I think money should only come from individuals and, you know, with a limit of, say, $5,000 per household per year.
Tom, thanks for the call. Ken, how do unions and their spending on politics stack up now in this era of the PAC?
Yeah, I mean, unions continue to spend heavily. Unions were, in fact, given greater latitude in their political spending by Citizens United. But the sort of universe of money that the union, from which the unions could draw, that is primarily union dues from their members, is and has been on the decline. And so, yes, they're spending a lot of money in politics, and they've always spent a lot of money in politics, but that's not really growing, nor has it really changed substantially from Citizens United. What has changed substantially is the money coming in from individual donors and to some extent from corporations, although that really, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing about a potential explosion in direct corporate spending in elections after Citizens United. That really hasn't come to pass either. I think some of that has to do with the corporate sort of evaluation of risk and the tendency to try to avoid risk by publicly traded corporations that could face a backlash if they were found to be subsidizing a campaign or a candidate, whereas individual political donors, individual wealthy, you know, billionaires, multimillionaires are the ones who have really availed themselves of this new flexibility in spending money in politics, and they're the ones who are really fueling this explosion of money in politics.
Ken, the race is still young. Not a vote has been cast yet. As a reporter covering this stuff, what are you watching for? What is the story you're watching for to emerge when it comes to campaign money?
Well, one of the big things that we're watching, I know a lot of folks are attuned to in Wisconsin, is the Koch brothers and the Koch brothers' influence in the Republican presidential primary. The Koch brothers and their and the donors in their network are poised to spend $889 million in the run-up to the 2016 election. That's both on politics and also primarily on policy, trying to shape public policy. But they have built really a shadow party, and many of these other donors on the left and right are sort of doing the things, taking on responsibilities and building infrastructure that are similar to what we've seen from parties in the past. So the degree to which these new networks funded by individual political donors are willing to wade into the process in ways that parties cannot or that parties do not, that is, weighing into primaries and saying, I like this candidate over that candidate, that's one of the things that I'm watching so far. The Koch brothers in particular have not waded into the Republican primary in a way that they have really thrown the full force of their political network and their spending behind an individual candidate. But if they did that, it really could be a game changer. Likewise, on the left, if we saw huge spending by a Democratic donor, a group of Democratic donors in primaries, it could really change the way that the nominating processes have worked.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Ken Vogel for joining us today. He's chief investigative correspondent for Politico. He's the author of the book, Big Money.
An internationally renowned exhibit is marking its 40th year at Wausau's Woodson Art Museum. As Glenn Moberg reports, there's more to birds in art than meets the eye.
It's opening night at the Woodson Art Museum. A chamber orchestra performs under a giant sculpture of two endangered whooping cranes. For the 40th consecutive year, Wausau is the unlikely host of one of the world's greatest displays of avian art.
We are just so delighted and tickled.
For museum director Kathy Kelsey Foley, Birds in Art has reached a milestone. 607 artists from around the world submitted their best work. Only 102 were chosen.
The cream of the crop doesn't even do it justice.
And as always, admission to the exhibit is free.
Spent a little time with that one here.
What do you find interesting about it?
You know, the spontaneity and honesty. He knows his birds.
Don Rombaut of Milwaukee admires a watercolor by British artist Darren Woodhead. Rombaut's own work has been featured at Birds in Art for 15 years.
90% of my work are birds.
You a bird watcher?
A bit, yeah. You know, where I am in Milwaukee, right on the migratory route, loads of raptors in the fall, all kinds of songbirds in the spring. I think we all care deeply about the birds and the environment.
A storm-tossed raven bristles in a charcoal drawing by Michigan artist Karen Bondarchuk. In 2008, Birds in Art featured her sculpture of a human-sized crow made out of tire scraps, a commentary on the environment and a then-struggling auto industry.
It's called Corvus deflatus, and it was a very large crow.
Bondarchuk believes crows and ravens have much to tell us about ourselves.
I see their behavior as being really close to our behavior. They're intelligent, they're annoying, they're able to adapt to pretty much anything that's going on. going on, and I see us doing pretty much the same right now with climate change going on. Humans are scrambling, trying to adapt.
Andrea Rich of Santa Cruz, California, found long-eared owls trying to adapt to a hot climate and turned the experience into a woodcut image.
Central California, it's hot, and there aren't very many trees, and the tree was filled with long-eared owls. There were about 14, 15 of them in the one tree.
Rich says in California, the people are also trying to adapt.
We're having a tough time out there. It is hot, 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 and very dry. We're in our fourth year of drought. A lot of fires this year. We have to completely rethink our water use.
What appears on the surface to be simple wildlife art often has an underlying political message. Guy Koliak is a New Yorker who finds refuge in his scenes of birds and big game animals.
When you grew up in the concrete jungles of New York, and you get down to the barrier beaches of Long Island, or you get into the woods, it's like a cathedral. It really is. I was raised going to church, but right now I feel closer to God in the forest.
A contributor for all 40 years, Koliak wants to stop the growth of concrete jungles.
If we keep spreading out and exchanging rivers and forests for concrete and glass, the animals aren't going to live in concrete and glass. If you like wildlife, if you like the outdoors, if you like nature, it's imperative that we try to preserve it.
Last year, the Woodson Art Museum used art to commemorate the extinction of the passenger pigeon. This year's artists hope that the birds they portray will not suffer a similar fate. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
And coming up, Waukesha set to lose 350 jobs as GE moves an engine plant to Canada. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can always follow us over at the Central Time Facebook page, join conversations about the issues of the day. Some good recipes up there toward the top right now. You can check them out, make them, let them know how they went. Also, feel free to tweet us anytime with program suggestions, responses to things you heard on the air on Twitter at Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.